Chapter 16.
The first time it happened was in South Africa in 2009, at a drop-in centre for kids living with HIV and its after effects. It was in the centre of Soweto, a place where orphaned children and kids who'd been forced to step up and become the head of their household could go and get things they needed, whether that was a hot meal, or counselling, or just help with their homework. We were visiting it because it was funded by the Elton John AIDS Foundation, and they'd put on a presentation for us. The women who ran the place and the children who benefited from it explaining how it worked. A small boy wearing the kind of brightly patterned shirt that Nelson Mandela had made famous presented me with a little spoon, a symbol of the South African sugar industry. But then he wouldn't go back and sit with the other kids. I don't know why. He didn't have a clue who I was, but he just seemed to take a shine to me. He was called Nusa, and he stuck to my side for the rest of the visit. I held his hand, pulled faces, and made him laugh. He was adorable. I wondered what his life in the outside world might be like. God, the horror stories you heard in South Africa about how AIDS had devastated lives that were no picnic to start off with. Where was he going when he left here? Back to what? But looking at him, I realised I felt something that wasn't just pity or fondness. There was a flicker of something else there. Something that was more powerful than just, aww. Something I couldn't quite put my finger on. I wandered over to David. This boy's just wonderful, I said. He's an orphan. Maybe he needs support. What do you think? David looked completely baffled. He had broached the subject of starting a family before. The idea of a gay couple adopting children was nothing like as anomalous as it had once been. But every time he mentioned the idea, I had presented him with a list of objections so long it just wore him into submission. I adored kids. I've got umpteen godsons and goddaughters. Some of them are famous, like Sean Lennon and Brooklyn and Romeo Beckham. And some of them aren't known at all, like the son of my AA sponsor. And I love them very much. But having your own children was a different matter entirely. I was too old, too set in my ways, too absent, always off on tour, too keen on porcelain and photographs and modern art, none of which respond well to being knocked over or drawn on with crayon, or smeared with Marmite, or any of the other things small children are famously keen on doing. Too busy to find the room in my life that was clearly needed to be a parent. I wasn't being grumpy, I was just being honest. But really my own childhood was at the root of every objection. Bringing up children was an incredible challenge, and I knew from personal experience how awful it was if you fucked that challenge up. You obviously want to believe you wouldn't make the same mistakes as your own mum and dad, but what if you did? I couldn't live with the thought of making my own children as miserable as I had been. All these protests, and now here I was suggesting we look into adopting an orphan from Soweto. No wonder David looked baffled. I was too. What the hell was going on? I had no idea, but something had definitely just happened. Completely out of my control. It was almost as if a real paternal instinct had finally kicked in my 60s. The same way my libido had unexpectedly arrived years after everyone else's when I was 21. Whatever it was, it didn't matter. We made some inquiries and quickly found out that the little boy was in a relatively good place. He lived with his grandmother and sister and another relation, and they were well looked after. A tight-knit family. So tight-knit that when Nusa attached himself to me, his sister had burst into tears, thinking we were going to take him away from her. That settled it. We wouldn't help him at all by uprooting him from his culture and his own identity and bringing him back to the UK. It was better to invest in his future in his own country. I saw him a few more times when I went back to South Africa to perform or to do work with the AIDS Foundation, and he was still completely adorable and clearly very happy. It was an odd incident, but I put it out of my mind, knowing that we had done the right thing. I retreated back to my usual position regarding children. I don't think either of us brought up the subject again. And then that same year we went to Ukraine. The orphanage was in Donetsk, a big industrial city in the centre of the country. It was specifically for children aged 1 to 11, a place where they could be monitored to see if they developed HIV. Not every child born to a mother with HIV tests positive. If they did, they got antiretroviral treatment, care and support. We were being shown around, handing out food, nappies and school books. Not lavish gifts, stuff they really, really needed, to the care workers and the kids. I played Circle of Life for them, on a piano I'd donated. Just afterwards, a tiny boy ran straight over to me and I picked him up and hugged him. They told me he was called Lev. He was 14 months old, but looked younger. He was so small. His story was horrendous. His father was a convicted murderer who'd strangled a teenage girl. His mother was HIV positive, a chronic alcoholic who had tuberculosis and couldn't look after her children. They didn't know whether he had HIV yet, although he had an older brother called Artem who had tested positive for the disease. Lev had blonde hair and brown eyes and a grin that seemed completely at odds with his surroundings and with the hand that life had dealt him. I just melted every time he smiled at me. I didn't put him down for the rest of the time we were there. Whatever had happened in Soweto happened again, only more intensely. There was an immediate bond, some kind of very powerful connection. I was in a raw emotional state anyway. A few days before, Guy Babylon, who played keyboards in my band for 11 years, had suddenly died. He was only 52. He seemed perfectly fit and healthy, but had a heart attack while swimming. It was a reminder that you only get so long, that you never know what's around the corner. Maybe that gave me some real clarity about what was important to me about life. Why try and deny how you really feel deep down about something as fundamental as fatherhood? The rest of the party moved on and I stayed behind in the room playing with Lev. I didn't feel I could leave. Eventually, David came back to see where I was. As soon as he walked in the room, I started gushing. This little boy is remarkable. He's called Lev. He's an orphan. He found me. I didn't find him. I think this is a calling. I think the universe is sending us a message, and we should adopt him. David looked even more stunned than he had in Soweto. Clearly, he hadn't expected his simple inquiry of what are you doing to be answered with a load of stuff about higher callings and messages from the universe. But he could see I was deadly serious. He told me to slow down and keep things low-key for the moment. We had to find out more about Lev's situation, about his family, about whether he could leave the orphanage before they knew whether or not he was HIV positive. I carried Lev around for the rest of the day. I was still holding him when we were ushered outside for a press conference in a makeshift marquee. I deposited him in David's lap while I answered the reporter's questions. The last one was about the fact that I'd said I never wanted children. Had seeing kids that needed homes in the orphanage changed my mind? Here was a perfect opportunity for me to demonstrate that I'd fully grasped what David had said about the need to keep any thoughts I had on Lev's future low-key. Instead, I blurted out that my mind had changed, that the little boy sitting with David in the front row had stolen our hearts, and that I would love to adopt him and his brother if it was possible. You may recall a few chapters ago that I explained why I'm pleased I became famous in an era before record companies and managers forced artists to get media training and watch what they say, that I'm proud of always giving straight answers and speaking my mind. Perhaps now I should qualify that statement by noting that there are a couple of points in my career where media training has suddenly seemed like a very good idea indeed, where I've wished that, for once in my life, I just answered a question by saying something unbelievably boring and bland and evasive rather than telling the truth. This was definitely one of those points. I realised I shouldn't have said it as soon as it came out of my mouth. Not least because I noticed David lower his head, close his eyes, and mutter something that looked very much like the words, "Oh shit." "That comment," he explained as we were driven back to the airport, "is going to go everywhere in minutes." He was right. By the time we landed in Britain, his BlackBerry was packed with texts and voice messages from friends congratulating us on our wonderful news, which meant it had already hit the media. Certain sections of the British press couldn't have reacted more negatively if I'd said I harboured a pathological hatred for children and was planning on personally burning down the Donetsk orphanage later that night. The Daily Mail and The Sun immediately dispatched journalists to Ukraine. One got hold of a government minister who said that adoption was impossible because we were a gay couple and besides, I was too old. Another visited Lev's mother, bought her vodka and took her to the orphanage for a photo opportunity, which automatically set any adoption process back by a year. In order for a child to become a ward of state, they have to have been in an orphanage for 12 months without a visit from any family member. The journalist either didn't know or didn't care. They hadn't thought about it. There was something really horrible, if inevitable, about the way the story became entirely about me and David and not the children involved. It was hard not to think that if I hadn't said anything at the press conference, none of this would have happened. Perhaps it would have made no difference at all, but we would never know. We kept trying, looking at the logistics of adoption, but it became obvious that it wouldn't work. We could have appealed to the European Court of Justice, but there didn't seem to be much point. Ukraine wasn't part of the EU. We had contacted a psychologist asking about the emotional process of introducing kids who'd lived in an orphanage into a family, and something he said really brought us up short. He told us he believed any child who had been in an orphanage for longer than 18 months would be irreversibly psychologically damaged. They wouldn't have experienced real nurturing. They wouldn't have been picked up and held and loved enough, and that would affect them in a way they would never recover from. So we gave up trying to find a way to adopt Lev and Artem. And working with a charity in the Ukraine, we concentrated on getting them out of there before their 18 months was up. Their mother died, and their father went back to prison. But they had a relatively young grandmother, and it was arranged that they should go and live with her. Through the charity, we quietly provided them with financial support. We were advised to keep it anonymous. So anonymous that not even Lev and Artem's grandmother would know we were helping. Because of the way the media had descended on them, if they found out I was their benefactor, there was a chance they would never leave the kids alone. The help we gave wasn't extravagant Elton John scale supports, which would have served only to isolate them more. But we made sure they had enough of the things that the charity told us they needed. Decent furniture, food, books for school, legal support. When the Russians invaded that part of Ukraine, we worked with the same charity that had funded the orphanage to evacuate them to Kiev. We'd always keep an eye on them. In 2018, when I went back to Ukraine with the AIDS Foundation, I saw Lev and Artem. They walked into the room in their matching hoodies, and we hugged and cried and talked and talked. So much time had passed. Lev was grown up now. He was a funny, cheeky, charming 10-year-old. But in one way, nothing had changed at all. I still felt exactly the same connection to him as I had the first day I met him. I still wish we could have adopted him. But I knew his grandmother had done a great job. We tried and failed to become adoptive parents. It was disheartening, but this time the paternal feeling didn't fade at all. It was like someone had jammed a switch on. I now wanted to have kids as much as David. But it wasn't a straightforward process. Adoption was still incredibly tricky for a gay couple, and the other option, surrogacy, was pretty fraught too. Transactional surrogacy is technically against the law in the UK, although you can have a child in a country where it's legal, then bring them back to live in Britain. We spoke to our doctor in California, and were introduced to a company called California Fertility Partners. The process is incredibly convoluted. There are egg donor agencies and surrogacy agencies, and there are tricky legal processes involved, especially if you live abroad. The more we looked into it, the more complicated it seemed to become. After a while, my head was swimming with hormone therapies and blastocysts, embryo transfers and parenting orders and egg donors. We were advised to find a surrogate who was unmarried. There were cases in the past of married surrogates' husbands making a legal claim to the child even though they had no biological connection. We decided to both contribute to the sperm sample so we wouldn't know which one of us was the biological parent. We were advised that everything had to take place under a veil of strict secrecy. We were to remain anonymous to the surrogates, adopting the guise of Edward and James, an English gay couple who were vaguely described as working in the entertainment business, while everyone else involved had to be bound by strict legal non-disclosure agreements. Having recently received a powerful lesson in the benefits of keeping my mouth shut, I thought that made perfect sense. When the media had found out the identity of Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker's surrogate, the poor woman had been forced into hiding. The last thing anyone wanted was an expectant mother being harassed by the press. Surrogacy involves a real leap of faith. Once you've selected your egg donor and left your sperm sample at the fertility clinic, your fate is entirely in the hands of others. We were incredibly lucky. We found an amazing doctor called Guy Ringler, a gay man who specialises in fertility for LGBT parents. And we found the most remarkable surrogate. She lived north of San Francisco and had been a surrogate before. She was completely uninterested in celebrity or money. All she cared about was helping loving couples to have children. She worked out who Edwards and James really were about 3 months into her pregnancy. She didn't bat an eyelid. David drove up to meet her outside of her hometown in case he was recognised. It was when he came back, gushing about how incredible she was, that everything suddenly became very real. I didn't feel any trepidation or doubt about our decision. No panic. No what have we done. Just excitement and anticipation. The rest of the pregnancy passed in a blur. The baby was due on the 21st of December 2010. We became very close to the surrogate, her boyfriend and her family. The more I got to know them, the more I started to hate the phrase transactional surrogacy. It sounded so clinical and mercenary, and there was nothing clinical or mercenary about these people at all. They were kind and loving, and genuinely delighted to be helping us achieve a dream. We arranged to hire a nanny, the same one who had looked after our friend Elizabeth Hurley's son. We knew her because Liz had stayed at Woodside after she had given birth to keep out of the media's glare. We began creating a nursery at our apartment in LA, but it all had to be done under the veil of secrecy. Everything we bought was sent to our office in LA, taken out of its packaging and wrapped so it looked like a Christmas present for David or me when it arrived at our home. When the due date drew close, the surrogate and her family moved to a hotel in LA. Ingrid and Sandy, who we had asked to be godparents, flew in for the birth. We planned to make a surprise announcement that we had become a family at a Christmas lunch for our friends in LA. But we had to keep putting the lunch off because the baby was late. Eventually, the surrogate got sick of sleepless nights, back pain and swollen ankles, and took decisive action. There was a restaurant in LA on Coldwater Canyon that served a watercress soup reputed to induce labour. The reputation was obviously fully deserved. We got a phone call on the afternoon of Christmas Eve telling us to rush to the Cedars Sinai Hospital. Still concerned about the veil of secrecy, I arrived in disguise, dressed down and wearing a cap. As it turned out, I could have arrived at the hospital in the 4-foot-high Doc Martens I wore in Tommy and my old glasses that lit up in the shape of the word Elton, and no one would have noticed, because no one was there. The place was absolutely deserted. The maternity ward looked like the hotel in The Shining. We learned that no one wants to have a baby at Christmas. They either induce or have cesareans to avoid being in hospital over the holidays. No one, that is, except us. We had deliberately tried to time the birth so that it would happen when I wasn't working or away on tour. So there wasn't a soul around, except for us and one other woman in the room next door, an Australian who had twins. And our son, who arrived at 2:30 in the morning on Christmas Day. I cut the umbilical cord. I'm normally incredibly squeamish, but the emotion of what had happened completely took over. We took our shirts off so the baby would have skin-to-skin contact. We called him Zachary Jackson Levon. Everybody always assumes the last name came from the song Bernie and I wrote on Madman Across the Water, but they're wrong. He's named after Lev. He had to be. Lev was like an angel, a messenger, who taught me something about myself that I didn't really understand. Lev was the reason we were there, on a maternity ward holding our son, knowing that our lives had just completely changed forever. As well as Ingrid and Sandy, we asked Lady Gaga to be Zachary's godmother. I had started collaborating with a lot of younger artists, everyone from the Scissor Sisters to Kanye West. It was always incredibly flattering to be asked to work with people who weren't even born when my career took off. But of all the young artists I collaborated with, I had a special bond with Gaga. I loved her from the moment I clapped eyes on her. The music she made, the outrageous clothes, the sense of theatre and spectacle. We were very different people. She was a young woman from New York, barely into her 20s. But as soon as we met, it was obvious we were cut from exactly the same cloth. I called her the bastard daughter of Elton John. I loved her so much. I got myself into yet more trouble with the press. I'd always got on fine with Madonna. I used to make fun of her for lip-syncing on stage, but the problem really started when she ran Gaga down on an American chat show. I got that Gaga's single, Born This Way, definitely sounded similar to Express Yourself, but I couldn't see why she was so ungracious and nasty about it, rather than taking it as a compliment when a new generation of artists was influenced by her, particularly when she claims to be a champion for women. I think it's just wrong. An established artist shouldn't kick down a younger artist right at the start of their career. I was furious, and I said some pretty horrible things about her to a TV interviewer in Australia, a guy I'd known since the 70s called Molly Meldrum. You can tell from the footage that it wasn't part of the interview, that I was just sounding off to an old friend between takes. You can hear people moving cameras around to set up the next shot while we're talking. But they broadcast it anyway, which brought that particular old friendship to a very swift conclusion. Still, I shouldn't have said it. I apologised afterwards when I bumped into her in a restaurant in France, and she was very gracious about it. Gaga turned out to be a great godmother. She would turn up backstage and insist on giving Zachary his bath while dressed in full Gaga regalia, which was quite an incredible sight. In fact, everything about fatherhood is incredible. I haven't got any great insights into being a father that you haven't already heard 100 times before. All those clichés about it grounding you, changing the way you look at the world, experiencing a love unlike any other love you've ever felt in your life. How awe-inspiring it is to see a person forming in front of your eyes. All are true. But perhaps I felt all those things more keenly because I never thought I would be a father until quite late on in my life. If you had tried to tell the Elton John of the 70s or 80s that he could find more fulfillment on a deep and profound level in changing a nappy than in writing a song or playing a gig, you would probably have had to exit the room at high speed immediately afterwards with hurled crockery flying past your ears. And yet it was true. The responsibility was huge, but there is nothing about being a father that I don't love. I even found the toddler tantrums weirdly charming. You think you're being difficult, my little sausage? Have I ever told you about the time I drank 8 vodka martinis, took all my clothes off in front of a film crew, then broke my manager's nose? We knew we wanted another child almost straight away. It was largely because we loved being parents so much, but there was more to it than that. However normal we tried to make our child's life, the fact is that it was never going to be entirely normal, because of what one of his parents did for a living and everything that comes attached. Because before he started school, Zachary always came with me on tour. He had been around the world twice by the time he was 4 years old. He'd been bathed by Lady Gaga and jigged up and down on Eminem's knee. He'd stood in the wings of shows at Las Vegas and had his photo taken by paparazzi, which, to my delight, he endured rather than enjoyed. Chip off the old block there. These are not the normal experiences of a toddler. There's obviously a degree of privilege that goes with being Elton John's son, but you would be fooling yourself if you didn't think there was also a degree of burden. I had hated being an only child, and it seemed right that he should have a sibling who he could share with, who would understand his experience of life. We used the same surrogate, same agencies, same egg donor, and everything fell perfectly into place again. Elijah was born on the 11th of January 2013. The only person who didn't seem delighted for us was my mother. My relationship with her had always been tough going, but it never really recovered after our civil partnership ceremony in 2005. As usual, things got smoothed over as best I could, but something about her had definitely changed, or at least been amplified. The drizzle of criticism turned into a constant downpour. She seemed to go out of her way to tell me how much she hated what I was doing. If I made a new album, it was a load of rubbish. Why didn't I try being more like Robbie Williams? Couldn't I write songs like that anymore? If I bought a new painting, it was bleeding ugly, and she could have painted something better herself. If I played a charity gig, it was the most boring thing she'd ever sat through in her life. The evening only saved from complete disaster by someone else's performance which had stolen the show. If the AIDS Foundation held a glittering fundraising dinner packed with stars, It was evidence that I was only interested in fame and kissing celebrities' arses. For variety, she threw in the occasional thunderclap of real anger. I never knew when they were coming or what was going to provoke them. Spending time with her was like inviting an unexploded bomb to lunch or on holiday with you. I was always on edge, wondering what was going to set her off. Once it was the fact that I'd bought a kennel for the dogs we kept at the house in Nice. Once it was Billy Elliot, apparently the only thing I'd done in about 10 years she thought was any good. The musical had really taken off in a way that no one involved in it had predicted, not just in the UK, but in countries where people had barely heard of the miners' strike or the impact of Thatcherism on the British manufacturing industry. The story at its heart turned out to be universal. Mum went to see it in London dozens of times until one afternoon when the box office misplaced her tickets for the matinee and took 5 minutes to find them, something she decided I had deliberately, meticulously planned in an attempt to humiliate her. Luckily, I followed Billy Elliot up with The Vampire Lestat, a musical Bernie and I wrote together which bombed. Everything went wrong, from the timing to the staging to the dialogue, and normal service was resumed. It provided my mother with the unmissable opportunity to inform me that she had known from the start it would be a terrible flop. I still tried to laugh it all off, or ignore it, but it wasn't that easy. If she wanted a row, Mum always knew which buttons to press, because she had installed the buttons in the first place. She still had the ability to make me feel as if I were a terrified 10-year-old back in Pinner, like everything was my fault. I was constantly in fear, metaphorically speaking, of getting a smack. The result was exactly what you would expect. I started to actively avoid her. On my 60th birthday, I had a huge party in New York at St. John the Divine, the same cathedral where I later saw Aretha Franklin sing for the last time. Mum had been one of the guests of honour at my 50th, the famous fancy dress party where she and Durf came as the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh, and I wore a Louis XVI costume with a train held by two men dressed as Cupid, and a wig so huge I had to travel there in the back of a furniture van. I had ample time to reconsider the wisdom of this idea when the furniture van got stuck in a traffic jam for an hour and a half. This time I decided not to invite her. I knew she would come and pour cold water on the whole event. She wouldn't enjoy it herself, nor would I. I made an excuse about it being too far for her to travel. She hadn't been well. But the truth is, I just didn't want her there. By the time Zachary was born, we weren't speaking at all. Mum had moved beyond just constantly criticising into going out of her way to try and be hurtful. She had delighted in telling me she was still friends with John Reed after our business relationship collapsed. "I don't know what you're so upset about," she snapped. When I pointed out this seemed a bit disloyal, "It's only money." That was certainly one way of describing what had happened. But the final row came when my PA, Bob Halley, left. We'd been together since the 70s, but the relationship had become strained. Bob enjoyed a very lavish lifestyle by proxy, and he didn't like it at all when the management tried to rein in spending to make my tours more cost-efficient. It's strange sometimes how fame affects the people around you more than it affects you. The flashpoint was an argument over which car service we should use. The management had brought in a more competitive company. Bob had got rid of them and employed a more expensive one. The management office overruled him and reinstated their choice of car service. Bob was furious. We had a big argument about it in the St. Regis Hotel in New York. He said he'd been undermined. His authority had been challenged. I said we were just trying to save money. He told me he was going to leave, and I lost my temper and told him that was fine with me. Later, after I had calmed down, I went to speak to him again. This time, he told me that he hated everyone at the Rocket office. Apparently, my entire management team were in his bad books. I didn't really know what to say to that. Your entire team or your PA? It's not exactly the toughest choice in the world. Bob announced that he was quitting his job and stormed out, adding as he left that my career would be over in 6 months without him. Whatever Bob's talents were, clairvoyance was clearly not among them. The only change in my career after he quit was the bills for touring expenses got noticeably smaller. My mum was absolutely livid when she heard Bob had left. They had always got on well. She didn't want to hear my version of events and told me that Bob had been more of a son to her than I had ever been. "You care more about that fucking thing you married than your own mother," she spat. We didn't speak again for 7 years after that phone call. There comes a point where you realise you're just banging your head against a brick wall. No matter how many times you do it, you're never going to break through. You're just going to end up with a constant headache. I still made sure she was looked after financially. When she said she wanted to move to Worthing, I bought her a new house. I paid for everything. Made sure she had the best care when she needed a hip operation. She auctioned every gift I'd ever given her. Everything from jewellery to platinum discs I'd had specially inscribed with her name. But she didn't need money. She told the paper she was downsizing. But it was just another way of telling me to fuck off. Like hiring an Elton John tribute act for her 90th birthday party. I ended up buying back some of the jewellery myself. Stuff that had sentimental value to me, even if it no longer had for Mum. It was sad. But I didn't want her in my life anymore. I didn't invite her to the ceremony when the law around gay partnership changed again, and David and I got married in December 2014. It was a much smaller, more private event than the civil partnership. We went to the registry office in Maidenhead alone. Then the registrar came back to Woodside and performed the ceremony there. The boys were ring bearers. We tied the same gold bands we had used in the civil partnership, the ones we had bought in Paris years before, to a couple of toy rabbits with ribbon, and Zachary and Elijah carried them in. I would say Mum missed out on her grandsons growing up. My auntie Wynne and my cousins flocked around the way normal families do when there are babies and toddlers to be fussed over and played with and treated. But honestly, she didn't care. When Zachary was born, a tabloid journalist doorstepped her and asked her how she felt about not seeing her first grandchild, looking for a scoop about the callously abandoned grandmother. He didn't get it. She told him she wasn't bothered and that she didn't like and had never liked children. I laughed when I read it. No points for winning yourself sympathy, Mum, but 10 out of 10 for honesty. I got back into contact with her when I found out she was seriously ill. I sent her an email with some photos of the kids attached. She barely acknowledged them. "You've got your hands full," was the only mention of them in her reply. I invited her to lunch. Nothing much had changed. She walked into Woodside and the first thing she said was, "I'd forgotten how small this place is." But I was determined not to answer back, not to rise to the bait. The kids were home, playing together upstairs, and I asked if she wanted to see them. My mum said no. I told her that I didn't want to talk about John Reed or Bob Halley, that I just wanted to tell her after all we'd been through that I loved her. "I love you too," she said, "but I don't like you at all." Oh well, at least things stayed cordial otherwise. We would talk on the phone occasionally. I never asked her what she thought of anything I'd done, and if I mentioned the kids, she always changed the subject. I managed to get her and Auntie Wynne talking again. They'd fallen out when Durf died in 2010, and Mum had refused to let Wynne's son, Paul, come to the funeral, telling her that Fred never liked him. So that was something. No luck building bridges between her and Uncle Reg, though. I can't even remember what the argument had been about, but they still weren't talking when she died in December 2017. I was incredibly upset when Mum died. I had gone down to Worthing to see her the week before. I knew she was terminally ill, but she hadn't seemed like someone who was at death's door that afternoon. It was an odd meeting. When I knocked on the door of her house, Bob Halley answered. We said hello and shook hands, which seemed to be the highlight of the afternoon as far as Mum was concerned. Mum was never one of life's tactile, nurturing, come here and give me a hug mothers. And there was a mean streak to her that went beyond being prone to bad moods or a victim of the Dwight family temper into something else entirely. Something I didn't like to think about too deeply because it frightened me. She seemed to actively enjoy picking fights. And not just with me. There wasn't a member of the family she didn't fall out badly with over the years. And yet there had been times when she was supportive. And there were times at the start of my career when she was really good fun. That's how people who knew her in the early 70s remembered her to me after she died. "Oh, your mum was such a laugh." We held a private family funeral for her in the chapel at Woodside. I wanted to remember the good things, with just relations around me. I talked about her at the service and I cried. I missed the person I was describing terribly, but I'd started missing her decades before Mum died. She just seemed to vanish, as quickly and unexpectedly as she turned up. At the end, her coffin was taken away in a hearse. We all stood there, what was left of the Dwights and the Harrises watching it go down the long drive at Woodside in silence. It was broken by my Uncle Reg, addressing his sister for the last time. "You can't answer anyone back now, can you, Sheila?" he muttered.